Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Before we begin today's show, I just want to let you all know that we're going to be talking about domestic violence. Some of the content we discuss might be very disturbing to some of you and might be inappropriate for small children. Every single minute, 20 people in the United States are assaulted by their partners. Domestic violence is the third leading cause of homelessness in the United States and a direct cause for half of homeless women. Around the globe, 50,000 women were killed by family members in 2017. That is according to the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. That same report called home the most dangerous place for women. Today's guest, Rachel Louise Snyder, spent 8 years traveling the country, following some of the most grim cases of murder and abuse, trying to find the links and come up with explanations for why this epidemic is spreading. Her new book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us, takes a long, hard look at the perpetrators of domestic violence and the lack of viable solutions for survivors. It is a deep and comprehensive dive into a problem we've spent decades learning to address in the United States, and she finds that so many assumptions and even solutions are wrong. Rachel Louise Snyder is associate professor at American University. She has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. She received an Overseas Press Award for her work on This American Life. And Rachel Louise Snyder joins us from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. This book was really hard to read. In fact, when we put the show together, I had to make sure the facts were right, because just reading this sentence, every single minute, 20 people in the United States are assaulted by their partners, I had to double check that every single minute was actually correct.
I know. And you know what's crazy is that even though I hear that stat, I forget there's so many stats in the book. And every time I hear it, it's like, oh, my God, that's right.
Right.
That's right.
You know? Yeah. And I think, Rachel, you know, your background is really interesting because you've spent a lot of many years reporting in places like Cambodia, Afghanistan, Niger, Honduras. And you write that you saw all the faces of women around the world from over two decades of your work. And you write, I realized how rarely I'd gazed inward at my own country, at what we got wrong and what it meant. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's absolutely right. And it's I don't know, I have a mixture of sort of like shame and shock when I think about that now, because I guess I had this, you know, I was raised in a family that really would say, well, this is the best country to live in. This is the best country to live in. And so whatever imperfections there were felt like blemishes as opposed to sort of deep fissures, if you will. And so I spent 20 years, more than 20 years, reporting on stories around the world. And the longer I spent outside of the U.S., the better perspective I think I got of the context of all of these social issues that we face. And it also made me really begin to be hyper aware of the ways in which we, particularly women who are victims, are connected across cultural boundaries and across, you know, linguistic and socio-political boundaries. And that domestic violence is, I mean, one of the things, one of the stats that I don't think I even have in the book is that there are 1 billion people across the world that are the victims or witnesses to domestic violence. 1 billion out of a world of 7 billion. I just can't think of any other issue of violence that connects so many people and is also so widely ignored.
Well, you come at this from an interesting perspective. Going back to your overseas reporting, you write that you have reported on young girls jailed for love crimes in Kabul, Afghanistan, Indian child brides who gave you interviews only in front of the men who controlled them, Tibetan women forcibly sterilized by the Chinese government. I mean, it goes on and on. Romanian women forced to birth multiple children. How do you think that experience, or what has maybe that experience gave you, what perspective did it give you when you set out on this project?
Well, I mean, it certainly gave me an acute sense that women were were second class citizens in much of the world. You know, I grew up with a father who really believed in education for me, and so I did. And I had four brothers, and I think we were all treated, you know, pretty equally. I was the one who worked on cars with my dad, so it was really a learning curve for me to see how women were treated around the world, and then to understand just how powerless they were. And then when I came back to the States and realized so many people in our country face the same sort of physiological, logistical, bureaucratic barriers, it was really stunning to me. I mean, I had always thought of domestic violence as this kind of shadowy background. You know, I didn't think there was anything we could do about it. I thought it was a something that, you know, befell those who made bad choices. All those assumptions I held, and I learned that they were all wrong.
And let's talk about just what went into this book. You spent months or even years interviewing victims only to have to toss all of those hours of interviews, because to even ask the abusers for an interview would have compromised someone's safety. And you write that one of the most difficult aspects of writing about domestic violence is that you're writing about a situation of such intense volatility that you risk endangering victims who are maybe in the middle of an explosive and dangerous situation. So how did you deal with all of that?
Yeah, and I'll tell you why I think I was able to put it in that sort of stark way for me. I lived in Cambodia for 6 years, and the last place I lived before I moved back to the States was down the street from a man named Ing Suri. And Ing Suri was one of the very few people, the handful of people eventually put on trial for war crimes tribunal, in the war crimes tribunals there. And I used to see him pull out in his Toyota Camry, pull out from his driveway, his grandkids would be playing around. And it was always shocking to me to think, how do these people get on living down the street from a man who killed so many of their relatives, right? And when I moved back to the States, I thought about that. I thought about how the Cambodians who were living in a post-genocide society with those who had terrorized them had to figure out how to rebuild their society and move on with their lives. Domestic violence victims don't actually get to the rebuilding part. If they have children, they are in a continual negotiation. And many of the victims I initially began to interview would spend hours with me, weeks with me, and then I would say, well, journalistic ethics demand that I talk to your ex. I just have to talk to him. And they would back out of talking to me, or they would say, you know, no, you can't. It's going to be terrifying. Like, you can't talk to him. He'll kill me if he knows I'm talking to the press. It happened over and over and over again. I think it makes reporting on this, it just adds to the complicating factor.
This section of the book really stopped me in my tracks. And again, just to let listeners know, some of this might be triggering for you, or it might be inappropriate for young children. You write, one woman I spent over a year interviewing had to withdraw from our talks for her own protection. She'd spent years with her abuser, and he used to hold her up naked to the heating pipes in their apartment or toss a blanket over her head and duct tape her around the neck. Her story of abuse and eventual freedom was among the most chilling stories I'd heard, even now writing this of her. I can include just these details because they don't identify her, and the particulars of the story, the heating pipes, the blanket, appear in so many other stories too. I mean, I just get the chills reading this. I think what really struck me was the heating pipes and the blanket appear in so many other stories too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's stunning to me. I mean, I think there was another detail from a story where a man would break CDs in half or DVDs and threaten to slit the throat of his partner. And that also I could include because it appeared in so many stories of domestic violence. It's chilling, you know, it's chilling when you think of those details. That woman in particular that you're talking about, just on a incredible note, came to one of my readings I did for the book tour, and a different woman in the audience came up to me afterwards and was right in the midst of this terrible situation. Her children had been taken from her. She had what appeared to be an undiagnosed traumatic brain injury from being beaten so much. And the woman who was in the book that you referred to with the heating pipes and the blanket overheard this conversation and has now become a domestic violence advocate herself and actually pulled that woman aside. It was really, I mean, I know this is beyond the scope of probably what you're looking for as an interviewer, but it was such an incredible, powerful moment.
Wow. No, we love stories. Luckily, we have an hour on this show, so you can take the time to tell us any of those kinds of stories. And I think that goes to the title, No Visible Bruises. So if your abuser is holding you up naked to the heating pipes, I mean, hopefully doesn't push you into them, that's not a bruise. And then the other story that's shocking is the story around Michelle and Rocky. And this is really shocking, and we'll talk more about this. But in this case, and I hope I have this right because there's so many characters and different stories in the book, but was Rocky the one who bought the rattlesnake?
Yes. Okay. Oh, he didn't buy it. He caught it somehow.
So this is another one. I mean, I had to read this twice. So he got a rattlesnake and kept it at home in a cage as a threat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Basically, if you don't do what I say, I'm going to put the rattlesnake in your bed.
This is one of the things that's so not really appreciated about the complexity of domestic violence, right? And it has such a knock-on effect with law enforcement and the courts and things like that, is that if you don't have physical signs of abuse and pretty drastic physical signs, you know, very often the charges will be downplayed in any kind of police report, and that means that the prosecutor won't prosecute, and the cycle goes on. Rocky had a rattlesnake that he kept in a cage that he threatened his wife with. You know, he said, I'm going to put it in the shower with you, I'm going to put it in bed with you. But he would also do something much more common, actually, that a lot of abusers do, which is use the children. Mm. He would, if Michelle did something that would upset him or he thought he was losing control, he would take the kids for a night and they'd go camping or they'd go to a motel and she wouldn't know where they were and she'd be frantic with worry.
Wow.
So you don't ever have to lay a hand on somebody to have this kind of abuse.
Right. And again, I don't like this question, and you had to address it in your book, but why don't they just leave?
I was going to interrupt you and be like, it's why don't they just leave?
Right.
I know it.
No, exactly. And when you're adding children to that story, I mean, you've got to figure out how you're going to support the children. So in this particular case, can you talk more about that? And we're talking about Michelle's young, her kids are young. It's not like you can just get up and leave and maybe go to a different state. It's not that easy.
Yeah. So in Michelle's case, she met Rocky when she was 14, got pregnant at 15. By the time she graduated high school, she had two kids. But they never married, actually. And she decided he wouldn't let her work outside the home. So that's strike number one, right, is this is not uncommon that they don't let their partner work outside the home, or if they do, they demand that the money be turned over to them and they control all the money. So he wouldn't let her work. He believed that, you know, it was up to her to take care of the house and the kids and all that stuff. It was a very gendered relationship and domesticity. But he would let her take classes. So when she went to Montana State University to apply for financial aid, they told her she was too young. She didn't have enough tax credit history to claim independence and thus didn't qualify for financial aid. So she said, well, what do I have to do to qualify? I've been living on my own since I was 15 with my partner, you know. And they said, well, get married and then you'll qualify. So the system forced her to marry a man that she was actively trying to leave. That was just one thing. Then she had no job history, so again, no way to raise the kids on her own. And one of her sisters was really concerned about her situation and talked about, like, why don't you go to California? Why don't you go to Arizona? And she would say, where am I going to go that he's not going to find me? I can't take the children away from him forever, right? I'll get thrown in jail for you know, parental alienation or, you know, whatever, kidnap, whatever. And so she knew she couldn't leave. You can't register your children in school without both parents' signatures, right? It's not like once they were in school, she could just up and move to a different state. She has no job history. And they live in a small town in Billings. And so her view was really the long view. She was like, I'm going to get my college degree and eventually somehow I'm going to get a job as a nurse, and that's how I'm going to raise my kids. So she was actively leaving. Mm. It's just that we don't know what leaving looks like. We don't know that it's a process and not an event.
What other laws or rules are in place that make it really difficult for people like Michelle to leave abusers?
Well, talking about laws gets complicated because, of course, different states have different laws. I mean, domestic violence in Montana, for example, will never be charged as a felony unless you have three domestic violence charges. The third one can be charged as a felony. So even though, for example, strangulation is under federal law a felony, you may not get charged the first two times in Montana for that. That's just one state. Here in Washington, D.C., where I live, strangulation is not a felony, even though it's a federal law. So it gets really complicated. If you don't have a police force who are trained in how to find signs of, for example, strangulation that are not visible to the naked eye, or you don't have investment in forensic nurses or forensic cameras that can pick up, detect bruising under the skin, then police reports are going to be downplaying those charges. And prosecutors are unlikely to prosecute, right? Prosecutors are terribly overburdened. So the more cases they can sort of get off their docket that appear to be sort of cut and dried, they'll tend to do it, especially if a victim like Michelle Monson-Mosier recants, as she did. And she recanted because she was terrified. She was afraid of Rocky.
What has changed with police forces? We just did a show last week about sex trafficking, and advocates have done so much grassroots work to encourage and put pressure on police forces to stop criminalizing people who have been trafficked. What does it look like for domestic violence victims and survivors?
Well, in the mid-90s crime bill that passed, one of the elements of that crime bill was mandatory arrest policies in domestic violence. So in some ways, that's been a double-edged sword because it means the police have to determine who the primary aggressor is and arrest that primary aggressor. And that actually means that while there have been many, many more arrests of domestic violence perpetrators, there are also arrests of victims very often. And so that's a complication. So, of course, I'll come on the show again some other day and we'll talk about the connection between the, mass incarceration and domestic violence. But that has had a really complicated effect on how we prosecute domestic violence cases. I think also that law enforcement still doesn't quite understand in many jurisdictions why, when they show up to a domestic violence call, the victim might be screaming at them and appear to side with her abuser. And the reason for that is fairly simple psychology, that of any victim of a severe domestic violence knows that she will have to continue to negotiate with that abuser once the police are gone. But the police don't always understand that dynamic. And so, you get a lot of like, well, she's crazy, or she seems unhinged or whatever. And it's all this sort of calculated play to keep the abuser from making things worse.
Today, we are speaking with Rachel Louise Snyder about her new book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. And if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a personal story to share about domestic violence, you can be anonymous. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Or if you'd like to share a story about a loved one, a family member, or a friend, if you work in this field, what are your thoughts about how law enforcement and the laws on the book deal with domestic violence? And if you have kids, how are you talking to them about these issues and what needs to change? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We had on Shannon Watts a couple of weeks ago. She started Moms Demand, and they are doing really incredible work around gun violence. And these numbers are absolutely shocking. In fact, Rachel, you tweeted this story from westward.com, and I think it's an independent paper out of Colorado, and I think the headline really just says it all. Every woman fatally shot in Colorado during the past year was killed by a man. They've got photos, and they've got the names, and what exactly happened. The gun violence numbers are really also quite shocking. Can you talk about that?
I think I just tweeted that yesterday, the day before. It's shocking to me. I mean, domestic violence exists all over the world. What doesn't exist all over the world is the access to guns. And when I first started my book tour, I sort of tiptoed around this issue because I didn't want to offend anyone. And then I just got angrier and angrier and angrier. And it was like, you know, the problem is that guns are so easy to get. The Every Town for Gun Safety organization found, and I have this in my book, that 54% of mass shootings are domestic violence in this country. Not that they predict it, not that they sit alongside it, but that they are domestic violence. Adam Lanza, for example, in Newtown, started with his mother. The very first mass shooting in this country with Charles Whitman at the University of Texas, you know, in the tower, people forget that he began the night before with his wife and mother. But I had a researcher come to my reading in Boston who said she's about to publish research that actually says that stat is much higher, 65%, she found. So I even think that the number in my book might be underreported, but it is a conversation. I have all the respect in the world for Shannon Watts. I'm a supporter of what she's done with Guns Demand. I have a friend, one of my closest friends, her brother 3.5 weeks ago went across the line from D.C. to Virginia, got a gun, came back, shot his wife and shot himself. That was June 7th. I came back from my book tour to that story. And he went to Virginia because it's easy to get guns there, not so easy to get them in the district. I mean, it's just the research shows again and again and again and again the connection between gun violence and domestic violence homicide. Mm.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that story. I mean, you actually had to take some time off your book tour because of that, right?
I did. It was a Friday morning. My friend called me. It was June 7th. I canceled everything for the next 2 weeks. This is actually one of the few, maybe the third interview I've done since then. It's been devastating. His sister's living with me now while she figures out what to do with their two orphaned children. And, you know, my daughter's having a really hard time. My daughter was really close to their oldest daughter, played in their house many, many times. Yeah, I've seen this issue from the outside for almost a decade. I have never seen it from the inside in quite this way.
Wow. Were they government officials? Or they worked for the government?
Yeah, he was a State Department. They were both Foreign Service officers, and she worked for the Commerce Department. She worked in trade policy. Both middle class, middle upper class, relatively well-to-do. They went to, our daughters were in school together, upper northwest, fancy suburb. Mm-hmm. kind of suburb. I mean, city here in D.C. And they were going through an incredibly nasty divorce that we all knew about. I mean, divorce is not unusual. It was unusually nasty. They were both invited to my book release party. I mean, wow. They both knew that this book was coming out. It makes me just sick to my stomach. Luckily, his sister is one of the wisest people I know and is herself a pretty nationally acclaimed therapist, so she's probably the best person to be in this situation. But it's devastated our whole community. Our kids are all the kids at the school have like a grief team for the whole summer that is available to them. My daughter's had nightmares. I mean,
Wow.
Ripple effect in the community, for sure.
We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking today with Rachel Louise Snyder, author of the new book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. You can find more about her book and her work at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Rachel Louise Snyder about her new book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Rachel Louise Snyder is an associate professor at American University. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. 137 women are killed by intimate partner or family violence around the globe every day. Here in the U.S., 20 people are assaulted by their partners every minute. Men are also victims of domestic violence, but 85% of victims and survivors are women and girls. And let's hear from our first caller. Let's go to Kay in Oakland. Hi, Kay. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. First, that's not my name. I'm calling anonymously. It's been over 2 years since I separated from my abusive partner. It was purely verbal abuse and property destruction, rage. But by making this call, all of the fear came back, and I'm shaking, and I can't seem to speak calmly. So I'm sorry about that.
Oh, I'm sorry, Kay. Kay, if you don't mind, would you like to share any information about, you know, what was available for you, how you got help?
Yeah, and just don't call me anything, please.
Okay.
My partner and I had two children together, and I had a child from a previous marriage and an excellent relationship with my ex, and that divorce was as healthy as it could be, and that child is doing really well. My ex with our two children had alcoholism and uncontrollable rage, Jekyll and Hyde, and it started right away, and I just hoped I could help. He would sometimes apologize. It was devotion and skin flaying rage and fearful, like dangerous rage. So why did I stay? Now I know more about that cycle. Having children made it worse, and the neighbors all witnessed this, and they were afraid to call the police. They heard the screaming and the racist screaming, and they were afraid for us that they didn't do anything. And one night in the children's bedroom, he threatened to shoot his head off right in front of them. They were very small. They were 4 years old. And he had a gun in the next room, and I took them and ran and went to the car. And then we went to a friend's house. The only police call I've ever made about him was a well check to see that he hadn't shot himself. But what he did was immediately apologize in text messages and moved out during the days that I was staying with the children with friends. And then he proceeded, he knows the system, he knows family law better than I, and he proceeded to file for custody. And then I became the respondent. And we went through, he stopped drinking, and we went through mediation for an entire summer, and then a very expensive custody evaluation. And during all that time, I was in a state of fear and intimidation, and the family law system, the professionals regarded his improvements as signs that he was really a responsible parent, and they regarded my fear and concerns about our past as signs that I was unreliable. And I risked at one point losing custody entirely of our children, of our girls. And I have a history of excellent parenting, and I have a big family. We spent a third of the year with. You can actually feel my voice is stabilizing as I think about the realities of my life, the good relationships. Mm. Now they're virtually, unless the children are with me, I'm not identifying their sex. Mm-hmm. They're not seeing their extended family, and it's very hard to get them there on with this custody rotation. He used to be virtually a stepfather to my older child. Now he never speaks of her. I won't mention the gender. So, and that he appears to have no friends. I don't know the names of his siblings. He refused to talk about his family. The point is that family law supported him with all of the evidence of a unbalanced personality and dangerous for children. It came down against me, and now we have settled on 50-50 custody. I've been cooperative, yeah. And I've never spoken ill of him to the children during the worst times. I said, Daddy's tired. He had a hard day at work. And I have never spoken ill of him. I am really a model of a good co-parent.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. Rachel, what are your thoughts about her comments about how she was treated by the system and family law?
Yeah, I mean, so many thoughts. Some of which extend beyond what my book covers, but which I'm sort of having my eyes open to again and again and again. I mean, the first thing is his threat of suicide. That's one of the top 20 high-risk indicators for domestic violence homicide. So we need to take threats of suicide seriously, not just for the people who are threatening suicide, you know, of themselves, threatening self-harm, but for their families as well. And I think the other thing is, you know, one of my goals, I guess, in talking about this book and going around the country is, well, I want to see what happened during the Me Too movement and the Kavanaugh hearings, where suddenly women around the country were sharing stories of what had happened to them with their fathers, their husbands, their brothers, their male coworkers. You know, I shared a story from when I was 13 with my father. And it normalizes the idea that sexual assault is real and we need to talk about it. We can only confront it and solve it if we talk about it. And I think domestic violence needs to happen. So when she says her neighbors were afraid, I absolutely believe that. But there's also so much shame involved in that. I'm sure that she was thinking, my God, what sort of terrible choice did I make in this man, right? And, you know, the other thing is, when I hear about family courts, it's absolutely true. Family courts are disastrous in many cases in this country. They give abusers parental rights again and again and again, and it just furthers the cycle of abuse. People have asked me, as I've gone around the country, you know, who did you write this book for? Who did you want to read this book? And, you know, I wasn't ever sure how to answer that. I would be like, well, I want victims to know that they're not afraid, they're not alone, and they're not crazy. But I also want perpetrators to like be able to see what they look like. But I'm starting to say judges. I want judges to read it, because judges hold so much of the power over these children's lives, and they're not making decisions always that are trauma informed. In fact, hardly ever trauma informed.
Well, thank you again for calling in and sharing your story. Let's go next to Mary in Albany. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. This is Mary. You know, I'm always shocked when I read about a woman being killed or viciously, violently attacked by a former boyfriend or ex-husband who's got a restraining order. And I'm wondering, why do restraining orders fail so much of the time?
Thank you.
That's a great question. So one thing that happens is restraining orders say to an abuser, the system is involved now. Somebody is watching you. So they very often escalate a situation. And what happens, like I'll give you the case of Michelle and Rocky in my book. Rocky only ever had the police called on him one time. And they came, they arrested him. He'd broken into his mother-in-law's house, kidnapped his daughter, and spent the night in a motel with her. And it was arrested the next morning. And Michelle went and filed, for the first time ever, filed a restraining order. That's when we learned about the snake. That's when, you know, she said that there was all this other physical abuse that had happened. But then Rocky's parents bailed him out, because he convinced them that he had made a mistake, he was changed, he was all the things that the first caller talked about, that manipulation and coercion, right? I mean, it's a misnomer that perpetrators of domestic violence are rageaholics. In fact, most of them are charming, lovely people, because that's how they get victims to love them in the first place. Only about 25% of domestic violence perpetrators fit that rageaholic mold. The rest of them know quite well how to act in polite society, in civil society. So Rocky was bailed out. And when Michelle found out that he had been bailed out, she immediately went and recanted her restraining order. And this gets at your question. Why do restraining orders not work? Because they incite somebody who is already abusive. What does tend to work, and there are many, many things, and I do, the book isn't all darkness. I do have some solutions in there. But one of the solutions, and for example, Montana did this in the wake of Rocky and Michelle's murder, suicide, familicide, really, the kids were killed too. They no longer let someone who's arrested for domestic violence bail out first thing in the morning. They can only see a judge in the afternoon. And it sounds like, well, what good could that do? But it's enough time for a domestic violence advocate to have gotten to Michelle or to get to a victim and create a safety plan, maybe change locks if they need to change locks, maybe get that abuser on GPS monitoring. I always tell jurisdictions to look in their bail statutes and see if there is a way in which they can prove someone's dangerousness and hold them for longer. So all of these things, you know, you cycles of violence or any kind of violent relationship does operate on a bit of a timeline. So when a system is involved, that is when the most dangerous times are. In the case of my friend's brother who killed his wife and killed himself 3.5 weeks ago, they were due in court that day. I didn't know that. Wow. I'm not sure anyone knew that except for their lawyers, but they were due in court that day and they never showed up.
Well, thank you for calling in, Mary. Let's go next to Melissa in Richmond. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. While I was waiting, I tried to put my thoughts down on paper because there's so much that this is bringing up. The first thing is that my parents were in a murder-suicide domestic violence dispute. My father shot my mother, killed himself. My sister witnessed the whole thing, and she was frozen in time. She could not move. She was 16 years old.
Oh, gosh.
If she moved, he could see her, right? And he was her stepfather. So this just rocked, you know, everybody's world. I was 9. My brother was 6. And in the process of coming out of it and trying to become a whole person, it's always shocked me that nobody else has ever had this happen to them. Like, when I was little, part of my way of dealing with the trauma was to tell everybody, oh yeah, this happened. And then I started becoming a really good detective to watch people's reactions. And who would withdraw, who could be trusted, who could not be trusted, who didn't have the emotional stability on their own to just be with me in those moments when I was telling them this story. And I wouldn't say that sophistication was right there when I was 9, 10, or 11, but as I grew older, I learned, oh, I have to keep the secret here. I'm not able to talk about this here. I'm not able to be genuine with these people because so many people are complicit in all of the systems that it takes to keep domestic violence secret. We're constantly we're making men hyper-masculine right. by disallowing them to have emotional reality. We use women's bodies as a way of tricking men into being complacent into this idea of hyper-masculinity. There's all these different things that we're doing with misogyny, with with all these different roles that we play. But I think that I'm really excited about having this topic on, because just knowing the numbers, that I am 1 in 7 billion people in the world that is part of the 1 billion that's had this happen, that I've either witnessed or been a victim of, makes me feel like I have more voice, and gives, I think, people a place for that emotional shock to rest and resonate, so that when they're with a victim, they don't add to the victim's victimization by acting so shocked that they separate her from society.
Hmm.
Or separate
yeah, absolutely.
Him from society.
Yeah. It's a way in which, like, the grief and the loss is so large, I think it makes us all uncomfortable to be around it. And you're so articulate and amazing. I wish I could meet you in person. Maybe someday. But I am so impressed that you're able to put all that together. And I completely agree with you about these incredibly limited roles, our expectations of how men are going to act and our expectations of women. I just tweeted like a month ago, how come, you know, for my whole life, I've seen cop shows on TV that at least every other storyline is some woman murdered, right? It is so normalized, and cop shows are so, like, they're their own genre. I don't think I've ever once seen a show from the viewpoint of, you know, domestic violence advocates. I see cops, I see hospital shows, mm-hmm. right? And yet, like, we don't ever show alternatives of women staying alive through these things, or men staying alive through these things, of men who are victims, who are not too ashamed to come forward, of LGBTQ or anybody who's not heteronormative. And then, you know, as she said, what do you do with the grief? It reshapes the way you move through the world.
Right. Wow. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Melissa. Today we are speaking with Rachel Louise Snyder about her new book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. We have a number of other people on the line, so let's try to get through as many as we can. Let's go next to John in San Jose. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. You know, very strange. Oh, thanks, Ms. Snyder, for doing this. I really appreciate it. And, you know, in a very strange relation with the previous caller's topic, I'm actually a victim of emotional abuse in a marriage. You know, I call this a strange coincidence, because the last caller talked about hypermasculinity in shows. But I also want to point out that there are situations in which men get abused too. And again, there are no bruises, so no one knows what's happening. I have been in a relationship with my current wife for about 15 years now. Some of them are married, and I did not realize for a very, very long time that what was happening to me and my constant source of disappointment and unhappiness in the relationship was not really my fault, but the way I was being treated. And I did not realize for a very, very long time that the way I was being treated is not really okay. And I have basically been in a pattern for so long that I'm completely different when I'm outside the house, and I'm completely different when I'm inside the house. I'm more of myself when I'm outside.
Mm.
So it becomes such a difficult pattern to break out of. It might sound strange to hear this, but I'm actually scared of impregnating my wife. But then, you know, one might think that I should maybe talk to her, but then it's not easy. And there is no physical abuse involved at all. And then added to this, there is, you know, constant tilting and manipulation and fear and all sorts of negative signs when we are just by ourselves. And there are some signs that I started seeing only recently after learning more about these topics and this whole phenomena of abuse, which I, again, blamed myself for the longest period of time in our relationship. And, you know, I just wanted to bring some light to this issue and wanted the guest, Ms. Snyder, to opine on this. And, you know, that's all.
I really appreciate your call. I'm so glad that you had the courage to call in. I think it's particularly difficult for men. And I think that we are wildly under-resourced when it comes to helping male victims of domestic violence. Ireland just started what I believe is the world's first domestic violence hotline dedicated solely for men. So they're doing some interesting things in Ireland around domestic violence. But I think that he's absolutely right that we often, while we're in the middle of a situation, don't recognize what it is. We don't name what's happening. And I think that emotional abuse, you know, when I have talked to victims around the country, it's always the emotional abuse that is so much difficult and so much harder to bear. I completely understand why you wouldn't want to bring a child into that situation. And I do want to encourage you to get out, actually. Mm-hmm. I think there are things that just are not fixable and you don't deserve that treatment. But, you know, I want to go back to Rocky and Michelle just really quickly. I know we have other callers on the line, but you know, Rocky had taken hours and hours of videotapes over the years of their family just doing, you know, camping or hanging around the backyard or whatever. And Michelle's father gave me copies of those videos, and I watched them all over the course of one summer. And one of the things I noticed was that Michelle was really beautiful, and she had a very beautiful figure, and Rocky would go film her like from the leg up. Like, he'd throw back the covers and he'd start filming at her feet and film her legs all the way up her body. And in the early years, she would kind of joke about it and be like, cut it out, stop it, that sort of sweet coupley, like, you know. And then as the years went on, you could see the kids getting older, so you can tell kind of where we are in time. She would get annoyed and she would say, stop it, I don't like it when you do that, stop it. And he never would. And in one of the final videos, a couple of months before he killed them all, they were hiking, they were in a cave, and so she went first, and then the kids, and then him, and he was filming, and he did it again, filmed her, you know, up her legs to her butt, and made some comment to the kids about, well, there's your mom, there's her, there's where her, you know, value is, or something, and not those exact words. And she didn't even mention it. Mm. And I thought, there in a visual is the loss of power and agency that caller is talking about. Right. That's why he's different outside the home than he is in the home, right? Because he's lost his agency mm-hmm. through that emotional abuse.
And just a quick question for John. If he were to seek counseling, for example, do you find that therapists are spending more time learning about this? Because I'm helping a family member with a mental health issue, and what I notice on the therapist's website or the psychiatrist, it really usually just says couples counseling. Are some people specializing in this kind of emotional abuse?
That's a really good question. I do think I've had a lot of emails from therapists who are reading the book, and I do think that there are elements of being trauma informed that are sort of special training programs that therapists need to go through. I mean, they can do cognitive behavioral therapy or, you know, prolonged exposure, but it has to be sort of trauma informed. And so I would not say in his situation that couples counseling is going to be particularly useful. Mm. I mean, unless his goal is to stay married and to get her to change, which to me could prove more frustrating than it's worth. I don't think that couples counseling is where it's at, because it's not just a matter of her being emotionally abusive to him or someone else, you know, being emotionally abusive. It's also a matter of him sort of finding his place again and his sense of self and his sense of agency. And, you know, I don't know that you can do that in a couples counseling situation.
Well, again, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story, John. And if Rachel has any resources for you, or if we find any, we will put them at yourcallradio.org. We have time for one last caller who's been waiting patiently, and we're almost out of time, but let's hear from Anonymous. Hi, welcome to the show.
I really appreciate the conversation today. It's so helpful.
and painful in the same sense, you know, because I've been through some of it myself. But in my situation, it's really my kids. We all went through it, but my kids were the ones who were abused. And I was just curious as to the perspective of kids from this whole thing. They really don't have a voice in the court system unless you have money to invest in a guardian ad litem or something like that. So in our situation,
I'm so sorry to cut you off, but we only have about 30 seconds left. Rachel, can you give us just a brief comment about children?
I can. And you're absolutely right. First of all, there is there's a wonderful camp for children of domestic violence called Camp Hope, Camp Hope America. They're all over the country, and it's specifically for children who have been in domestic violence households to try to break that cycle. And, you know, guardian ad litems are also, they tend to be lawyers, right? They're not necessarily trauma-informed either, so they don't always know exactly what they're dealing with. And she's right. This, again, gets to a real crisis in our courts, which does not, unless you're 14 or older, as a child, a judge may or may not talk to you, may or may not listen to what you want, right? And so as a child, it's particularly disempowering. And, it's something I'm thinking about more and more.
Well, thank you for calling. Rachel, we didn't get to spend much time on solutions. The other thing I really wanted to talk to you about, but I felt like getting callers was more important, was the section on your book about the men that you met and you interviewed. You also visited a couple of programs that have conversations between men who have been victims of violence at home and possibly were perpetrators. So we would love to have you back in the near future to talk about that section of your book.
I will do that. I would love that, especially because one of the great programs I went to was in your area.
Right.
So.
The San Bruno Jail?
That's right.
Yeah, that was fascinating. So I'd love to have you back to talk about that.
Anytime.
Okay.
I would love that.
Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Rachel Louise Snyder is author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. You can find more of her work at yourcallradio.org. And I just want to say thank you so much to everyone who called today, and we will definitely have Rachel back to continue this important conversation. Thanks to Andrew Stelzer for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance, who answered the phones and is also our studio engineer. Thank you, Kevin. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.